From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. To parents, it can look like slacking. For young people, it can feel like torture. The years before full adulthood in the U.S. today are more drawn out and maybe more confusing than ever. And experts say it's a phenomenon right across the economic spectrum. Tonight on Point, today's 20-somethings, back home in the basement or out in the world, putting off full adulthood. But first, the airline industry is feeling new turbulence from Delta's announcement that it is dropping fares across the board to try and recapture air travel market share. The move is putting new downward pressure on all airlines and sparked an immediate announcement from American and others that they will match the cuts. Joining me now from Chicago is Michael Arndt, senior correspondent at Business Week magazine, where he covers the airline industry. Michael Arndt, thanks for being with us tonight.
You're welcome. Good evening.
Good evening. So what's going on with Delta's cuts? What's pushing this? Why? And why do the other big airlines feel they've got to follow?
Well, Delta is being pushed into this because it's up against discount carriers such as AirTran in its hometown and, to a lesser extent, JetBlue and Southwest, which are undercutting it on pricing. And Delta's response is, if you can't beat them, join them. And that's why the other majors are following as well. If Delta has a fare of, say, $200 round trip on a particular route, American or United or Northwest certainly has to match it, or the public is going to book on Delta.
But the low-fare airlines, Southwest, JetBlue, AirTran, they've been there for a while now. Why has it taken so long, or why is it now that Delta and the other majors are coming around to these fares?
Well, the discounters, you're right, have been around for a while, but they've really gained, if you will, critical mass. They've taken over a much bigger chunk of the domestic market, and they're a force to be reckoned with. They're the ones who are really setting the agenda today, not the major carriers.
I'm reading here they're now carrying a quarter of the nation's travelers. It's huge.
Yes, on a domestic front, that indeed is huge. And you've seen how aggressive Southwest has become, moving into Philadelphia, taking advantage of U.S. Airways, and now moving into Pittsburgh, again taking advantage of U.S. Airways troubles.
Now, these low-fare airlines have got, almost one-fourth of domestic air travel now. Last year, they made money. The major airlines collectively lost $5.5 billion, but they were charging higher fares. Why were they losing money when they were charging more?
Well, their expenses are generally a lot more, and that's the problem. And it also raises the question of what are the folks at Delta thinking? If you're losing money at your high fares, it sort of defies logic to then think, well, let's go out and cut fares and we'll end up losing more money.
So what are they thinking? Is this a game of attrition? Are they hoping they can knock someone out of the box up in the major airlines category, U.S. Air, which is in bankruptcy again, for example?
I think they are. I think what we've got is a game of chicken going on here, that the majors all know that their days are numbered unless they can convert themselves into a discount carrier. And that's what Delta's gambit is. It's trying to adopt some of the discount carriers' airfares. But it also needs then to adopt the discount carriers' cost structure. And they're not there yet. And that's why they're losing money. And that's why this is going to cost the industry upwards of $3, $4, maybe even $5 billion of lost revenue in 2005 till this game of chicken is decided.
On top of the many billions they're already losing in 2004, what about for consumers and travelers, Michael? Delta's specific cuts were largely focused on business travelers, but how is this likely to affect fares and the quality of air travel overall?
Well, I think you've hit on it. For business travelers, this is a good thing, to watch what Delta's done and watch its competitors match it. For leisure travelers, I think the impact is very minimal. And in fact, Delta's fares are often still higher than what you'd see on a Southwest or an AirTran or a JetBlue. The business traveler, of course, though, benefits from this and will, as Delta's competitors, match these fares.
So the cap that they've put down on, $4.99 is the highest you're going to pay for a one-way fare anywhere in the country. That's for business class travel?
No, that's for a ticket that a business traveler might buy.
In other words, a short turnaround.
Sort of the last-minute fares. Business travelers often put off their travel plans to the last minute. They want flexibility, to be able to change the ticket at the last minute or take a different flight back. Different from a vacationer who knows definitely I'm leaving on a Friday afternoon and coming back 2 weeks later.
What does it mean about likely long-term fares? Are we seeing the whole fare structure drop down permanently, or if some players get knocked out of business, might it spike back up again?
I think we're in for cheaper fares for the long haul. Air travel has become a commodity, and as such, it sells on price. People don't buy tickets really on service. They buy them, of course, if they fly to the city you're going to. But you really make your choice on who's got the best fare, and therefore that's the game now. Who's got the best fare?
Well, a lot of great ones out there right now. Michael Arndt, thanks for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
Michael Arndt, senior correspondent at Businessweek magazine. He spoke with me from Chicago. Young Americans are going to school longer, getting married later, and facing more options and questions when they head into the job market. Many are putting off careers. Many are finding safe havens with their parents or their parents' cash while they're riding out their 20s. The trend is pushing the age of what looks like full adulthood with all its obligations and commitments farther and farther from the teen years. Tonight on Point, the 20-something limbo. The new phrase is emerging adulthood, and it has big implications for young people and their families. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you 20-something and feeling betwixt and between, not ready or able to take on the full trappings of adulthood? Are you a parent watching your 20-something offspring job hop, drift, maybe move back home? What's going on here? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Jeffrey Arndt, Associate Professor in Human Development at the University of Maryland. He's author of Emerging Adulthood, The Winding Road from the Late Teens Through the 20s, which says American adulthood is in the midst of a quiet revolution. Jeffrey Arndt, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hello.
Hi. So you're not saying it's brand new. You're saying it's going on for a couple of decades now. But what is happening to young adulthood? Why is it that you can talk with to any family who's got kids, young children in their 20s, and you'll hear stories of them back in the basement after college or kind of working some job, not really a career-oriented job, several years after they've graduated or out of high school and still kind of bopping around, not locking in? What's going on?
Well, they have more options than they used to. They wait longer until they make the definitive transitions of adulthood, like marriage and parenthood and getting a long-term job, because they're really intent on finding the best possible job and the best possible marriage partner. And they're in no particular hurry to enter adulthood with all its responsibilities. So they take that period from the late teens through at least the mid-20s, sometimes the late 20s, to explore their possibilities in terms of love and work and where they want to live, things like that. And so now you have effectively a new stage of the life course that's developed over the last few decades. You used to go right from adolescence to young adulthood, but now I think you have adolescence and then this period of emerging adulthood where you're finding your way into adulthood, and then finally young adulthood once you reach your late 20s, maybe your early 30s.
Young adulthood coming that late when not so many decades ago people would have families well underway. Is it fair then to call 20-somethings today, or at least those following this more winding path, not yet adults? Is that an insult to them, or is it just recognizing a reality, or how do you see it?
Yeah, I don't think it's an insult to them. I mean, I think that's the way they describe it to me. They don't feel like adolescence anymore, and it's a mistake to call it an extended adolescence, I think, because they're not in puberty anymore. They're not in secondary school. By and large, they're not living with their parents, although some do. They're not as economically dependent on their parents as they used to be. So they're in this period where they're making their way into adulthood, and they're trying to find good options in terms of love and work. I don't think it's a case of them being slackers or being behind. I think they have the luxury in this generation of not having to rush into those commitments. And the way they look at it is, why hurry? Why not take your time and try out various options so that you can have a better chance of finding just what you want?
You know, of course, not everybody sees it that way. We see a headline in the Wall Street Journal this week talking about the coddling crisis, as if parents are underwriting, you know, long extended experiments in laziness or slackerdom. We'll come back to that. You write, though, in your book, Emerging Adulthood, you say that as recently as 1970, the typical 21-year-old, this is American, was married or about to be married, caring for a newborn child or expecting one soon. done with education or about to be done and settled into a long-term job or the role of full-time mother. That's at 21, a long way from what we see now.
Yeah, it's hard to believe for most people who are 21 now that it was that way just as recently as 1970. But I think to call it a coddling crisis is a big mistake. I mean, why make it so pejorative? They're not just lying around doing nothing. In fact, they often have very full lives. Very often they're trying to balance both school and work, as well as have some kind of social life. They're under a lot of financial pressure typically because even if their parents are helping them out, they really want to be financially independent. And in a lot of cases, their parents can help them out. And the sorts of jobs they can get tend to be low-paying jobs that are at the bottom of the ladder. So I don't think it's coddling at all. I think they're very hardworking and they're very intent on creating an adult life for themselves. They're just not in a real great hurry to do it. I mean, I don't see what the advantage would be to them getting married at 20 or 21 and having a child at 22. Why should they?
Well, and here now people living much longer than they used to, so I suppose there isn't quite the same rush. And yet, you know, society has trouble shifting gears sometimes, and I know from personal conversations that a lot of these 20-somethings, they can often feel pretty, tortured or unhappy during these years. It's not all like a beautiful exploration of a lovely garden.
No, but it's not all negative either, and I don't think it's like torture for most of them. I mean, it's true there's some anxiety associated with it, and as I said, they have very full lives, and they're often under a lot of pressure from all the different things they have to do. But at the same time, it's a great time of life in terms of the freedom of it. It's really the freest time of life in many ways. You're no longer really dependent on your parents. Mm-hmm. They don't control you the way they used to, and you're not yet committed to the roles of spouse and parent that are also very restrictive. So they really enjoy the freedom, and they're very optimistic. That's one of the most striking things about it. I call it the age of possibilities because they have such high hopes for the future. Just about all of them think they're going to find a great job that pays really well and find their soulmate, even if right now they're dateless and jobless.
And penniless sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the source of that sense that it's all going to work out? You know, again, maybe a few decades ago, people felt a kind of sweat on their brow. They had to make a living to support the family, but they felt like they had to hook into a career for some kind of security in life. What's fueling this 20-something notion that it's all going to be great one day, no hurry?
Well, I think it's just youth, basically. I mean, the fact that their dreams haven't really been tested in the fires of real life. Before you get an actual job that you're committed to, it's easy to dream of that job that's going to be wonderful and fulfilling and pay really well before you have anything in reality to compare it to. In the same way with love, I mean, before you actually choose a marriage partner, it's easy to dream of a soulmate because you don't actually have that person lying next to you in the morning, you know, snoring and smelling a little funny. So the dreams hasn't been tested yet. It will be eventually.
And you say that long testing is a good thing. Why rush into it? Why come down with this decision or that on love or career? Why not use the 20s to explore?
Yeah, as you said, people live longer. And the other important thing, Tom, is that they have fewer children. If you go back 40 or 50 years ago, the average woman had 3, 4, even 5 children. And now most people only want 1, 2, rarely 3. So if you're only going to have a couple of kids, why not wait until you're 30 to commit yourself to that? Once you do that, really, the party is over, and you're going to have enduring responsibilities that are very difficult to get away from. So I think that it's a healthy thing for them to wait until they feel they're ready and they feel they're mature enough to take on those great responsibilities.
Well, a lot of possibilities there, but also a lot of looking back and forth between generations, parents wondering what's Jessica or Zach doing back home. Jessica and Zach may be having a good time, but wondering what they're one day going to do. Jeffrey Arnett, stand by. We've got to take a short break here. I'm joined tonight by Jeffrey Arnett, author of the new book, Emerging Adulthood. We're talking about today's 20-somethings, back home, in the basement, or out in the world, putting off full adulthood. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What do you think? Is there a problem with putting off the ways of full adulthood? Do we have a coddling crisis, a quarter-life crisis? Do we need a new name for the 20s, maybe emerging adulthood? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about today's 20-somethings back home, maybe living in the basement after graduation, or out in the world, drifting a bit, putting off full adulthood. The new phrase from Jeffrey Arnett, who joins me tonight, is emerging adulthood, and it has big implications for young people and for their families. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Are young adults today slacking? Or just assessing, responding to a new reality? Is this a sign of society gone soft, of young adulthood getting harder, of something new? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Max is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Max. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind, Max?
Well, I'd like to I'm speaking as a 21-year-old typical liberal arts student, and I think this is highly resonant with me. I'm very glad to hear this being discussed, and I'd like to take a stab at naming what this generation of mine is.
Great, let's hear it, my friend.
I think it's the reset button generation.
The reset button. Of course, it would be from computers, but what do you mean by that?
Right, or video games. I mean.
Or video games.
My grade was the first grade to dress up like Super Mario for Halloween. We're,
right.
We're this post-chores group of kids who just don't want to fail, and every time they do fail, we grew up with this console that you could just press a button and start all over. And I think we see that now. My college has this thing called the Career Center, which encourages internships.
Right.
And you're supposed to have two internships before you graduate, and that'll prepare you for the transition period. But the Career Center is the least popular of all my, it's not as popular as the pool tables. And I just see even people being prepared, there's not much difference when all my friends come home who don't go to school and my friends who come home who do.
That is, those that go to college and those that don't.
Right.
Not much difference in what, Max? In their outlook, in their ambitions, what?
Well, I feel like the people who go to college become more interesting people, but they don't, I mean, the work ethic doesn't change. I mean, the summer jobs are the same as the jobs that work all year round.
Right. Max, let me ask you then, what year are you in college now?
A junior.
And you're 21, so it's not that much longer until you're going to be out in the world. Are you looking forward to jumping into a career, trying to jump into a career, or do you imagine along what Jeffrey Arnett calls emerging adulthood with your reset button always nearby?
Well, I think a lot of us, and me especially, are hopelessly romantic, and I don't want to so much emerge as be an artist or nothing at all myself. And I think that sort of, Eugene O'Neill did it, so why can't I? Attitude is so pervasive that this emerging period is somewhat unavoidable for people who aren't willing to settle down and do the job that their parents had.
Yeah. Max, we've got it, and we thank you so much for calling in. Good luck with whatever it is when you get there. Jeffrey Arnett, how about it? Here's another potential name for this generation, this age, the reset era. I love the way Max describes it, the post-chores video game generation, where the Career Center at college is a lot less popular than the pool tables. But is this really new? I mean, a lot of young people for many years have wanted to be the artist or nothing at all for at least 5 minutes sometime in their life.
Right. I think it's a pretty cool name, the reset generation, but I don't think it's really generational. It's something that's been around for at least 15 to 20 years, and I don't think it's going to change. It's not like, in 10 years, people are going to go back to getting married at 20 and having their first child at 21 again.
Mm.
I think the changes are here to stay, which is why I like to look at more in terms of a new life stage that's been added to the life course rather than a generational thing. I don't think it's going to change. But I think he really hit a lot of good points in terms of the optimism and the high hopes that they have. And I do think that even though partly those high hopes are just a product of being young and not having your dreams tested, I do think that this generation has higher expectations, both for love and work, than was true in the past. As he said, they don't want to just do what their parents did, because for the most part, what they see their parents doing is not ultimately fulfilling in terms of their work. And they look at their parents' marriages too, and they think, oh, I can do better. This marriage looks kind of dull. Or, of course, a lot of their parents have divorced. And they think, I'm going to find my soulmate and find true love. So I think they have very high expectations compared even to their parents' generation.
So a lot of divorces in their parents' generation, maybe a lot of grim careerist baby boomers. Of course, that's not the way the baby boom began either. They're talking about hopelessly romantic. Jeffrey Arnett.
They had their own high hopes back then.
They sure did, and many still do, but a lot of things can get stretched out. Jeffrey, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation tonight from Pittsburgh, Linda Perlman Gordon. She's a psychotherapist who specializes in family therapy. She's co-author of, get this one, Mom, Can I Move Back In With You? A survival guide for parents of 20-somethings. She's herself the mother of a 30-year-old who moved back in after college for about a year. She also has a 21-year-old, Linda Perlman Gordon. Thanks for being with us tonight.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And in fact, I actually spoke to Jeffrey when I was researching my book. So I think this is a very interesting dialogue.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So, okay, there's the question. Mom, can I move back in with you?
Mm-hmm.
What's the right answer?
Well, the right answer has to do with your family circumstances and also your child. What we found, and again, I think what Jeffrey is saying about emerging adulthood, I agree with 100%. What has happened with the parents is the parents were very unprepared for the fact that their kids were not going to act like they did when they were 22 years old. And so now you have a lot of kids for all of these very responsible financial reasons that want to and expect to move back home. And if you're a parent that is not about to move out of your house, and your child is going to have an unpaid internship, and it's going to make them more employable, then you very well might say yes and be very happy about it. You know, I myself had my daughter move back in before she went to graduate school, and it was actually a wonderful period of time. But partly because she was responsible, and she was being financially responsible, and she was being personally responsible.
Was she doing dishes?
You know what? She was doing dishes if she ate, and we didn't even expect her to eat with us, and
right.
That's part of the fact that she was older.
And yet, you know very well that it wasn't that long ago that parents would have sort of looked around at a 24, 25-year-old who was still living at home and wondered if they had a crisis on their hands, a kind of someone who just couldn't fit into society, a spinster in the making, heaven forfend. And at a certain point, I think many parents still wonder, it's great to be with, Johnny or Jane, but is this mooching?
Well, you know, this generation, 62% of college seniors that are questioned expect to move back home. Whether
wow.
they do or not is a different issue, but that's their expectation. So what's interesting is think of how you're picturing them. And so they're feeling very much like, am I the only one? And the truth is they're in the majority.
62%.
And so what we have to do is we have to hurry up and start thinking about this in a new way.
Linda, do you see a changed economic reality out there, not just what's going on inside the heads of people in their 20s about how they want to shape their love lives, their careers, as Jeffrey Arnett says, but are they coming into a different economic reality that's simply less receptive somehow? If they wanted to go straight out and start a career, is it somehow more difficult than it was 20 years ago, 30?
Well, one thing is they can't afford in an entry level job. You can't afford an apartment that's going to be, you know, and I actually am in Pittsburgh this evening, but I live in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And so you can't afford a $1,000 apartment if you're making, you know, an entry level salary. And so that reality is there. The reality of if you think about first time homeowners, I owned a house when I was 26 years old, and the price of my house was the same as my car now. And that's very different for our kids. So absolutely, the economic realities, I think it's pretty...
Well, we've got a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. Sure, Jeffrey first. Yeah.
If I could just add, Tom, I do think that economics are part of it, but I think it's more a function of their high expectations. They don't want to just get a job. They want something that's really going to be personally fulfilling. And so moving home again allows them to look for the job that's just right. And it's true that, you know, it's more expensive, you know, expensive to get an apartment in the city and
yeah.
so on.
Yeah.
But they've grown up in a very affluent generation, and they have very high material expectations. So they don't expect to have to scrimp and save for years before they buy a car, for example.
But is that unrealistic? I mean, for a long time there was the idea when you went out on your own, you would dip in your standard of living. You would have to, you know, sort of take a hit and gradually build up your own affluence to stand on if you were lucky enough to do that. Is that passé? Is that an old-fashioned idea now?
Yes, I think it is. I think they expect to live at a high level. They expect to have a car and a fairly new one, and they expect to have cable TV, and they expect to go on nice vacations and so on.
And you're saying more power to them, or is that unrealistic?
Well, I don't know. It worries me a little because I think a lot of times they end up deeply in debt by the end of their 20s and spend the next decade or more getting out of it.
That does not sound like fun.
They tend to spend... They've grown up with these expectations, and they spend more money than they have, and they go into credit card debt and so on.
I want to get to our callers. There are about 4 billion who want to join this conversation. Joe is calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you, sir?
Great. What's on your mind, Joe?
Well, I just want to say sometimes it's not economically feasible for a person my age, which is 24, to be out on their own. I just got out of the military about 6 months ago, and after I got out of the military, well, I moved back with my parents and going to college full-time, and I can't really handle much more.
Well, if you're going to college full-time, who couldn't understand that? What's your parents' response, their attitude, Ben Joe, to you moving back in?
Well, they're pretty much fine with it. I mean, they're really supportive. They had to do it when they were just starting off, and they were married at 22 out of college.
Mm-hmm.
And they understand it completely.
Do they give you the eyeball sometimes, like, what are you doing, young Joe, or not?
No. They hear my stories from the military and, like, how I didn't ask them for anything, and I bought a good vehicle, paid for my own rent. It's not like I was immature or anything like that. And they think I'm progressing with my life quite well.
We hear it. Joe, let me ask you, at what age would you look around at yourself and say, Joe, what the heck am I doing here?
Oh, 27. Once I get done with college, I'm getting a job and, making it happen.
27. So there's a new kind of departure point. Joe, good luck with it, and thanks very much for your call. Let's get another call here from Amesbury, Massachusetts. Barbara's calling. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening. I want to echo the sentiment about the harshness of the economic realities. I'm in my mid-50s, the mother of a 23-year-old graduate student, and he and all of his close friends still live at home with their parents.
He and all of his friends at 23, 24?
Yes.
Wow.
Nobody has really ventured out into the world, and it's economics. When I was younger than him, when I was 17, I was able to move out on my own into Boston, work a marginal job in the old Necco candy factory, and live in a women's rooming house for $11.50 a week, which included two meals a day.
Well, is your son prepared to go out, work in a candy factory, and live in a men's boarding house?
I think if those kinds of things were available, I think that young people would be, I think kids would do that.
I have to challenge you on that. Maybe you mean that, but would your son really be ready to take a job mixing candy and living in a bunk bed with strangers?
Actually, it wasn't. It was a lovely townhouse on Newbury Street.
Oh, now it's sounding pretty good.
It was nice. But I feel like I had a lot more options in my late teens, early 20s than young people do today. I think that, the factories are gone, the farms are gone, and the tech jobs and service sector are going. I think they're frightened. I think that they worry about the debt that they have assumed going to college. That they're not ever going to be able to pay it off and get ahead in the world. I really, really see that the economy as the thing that is keeping them from moving ahead and becoming more independent.
Barbara, we've got it. And there's full sympathy from a 50-something mother with a 20-something-year-old son at home. Barbara, thanks very much for your call. Linda, you hear the story there.
Well, I want to add something that we didn't discuss.
Yeah.
If you think of, we got to put this in a sociological context. There is way less of a generation gap between 20-somethings and their 50-something-year-old or late 40-year-old parents.
Than 20, 30 years ago.
Absolutely.
That is true. I can attest to that.
We share the same music.
Mm-hmm.
We share, I could have my son call me and tell me to watch The Sopranos, and we'll discuss, Sex and the City. And that really links the kids to us in a way where to move back home is just not that bad.
It's not like living with Martians.
No. And now there's another thing, which I think is part of the coddling idea, is that we have parents, baby boomer parents, had such great expectations for our kids that, in a sense, it's not only do they want to do great things, we expect them to do great things. And so, in a sense, we have built this sense of entitlement, which actually can bite them in their 20s when they have to get a little bit more realistic about what their dreams might be in life.
Are you saying that they're embarrassed to kind of, you know, get down in the dirt where you start a career and do the bottom rung things that are required to get started?
It's not embarrassment. I think what we've done, what many parents, and this is probably a middle class, upper middle class comment that I'm making right now, many of us gave our kids many opportunities. And what happened is we didn't really let them fail, and they didn't get some of the skills on the way that we got, that I got when I flew alone on an airplane for the first time in my life at 18 years old to a college I'd never seen.
So are parents repairing that damage when they keep their wings open over their kids well into their 20s, or are they extending that damage?
If they learn some of the markers of adulthood, markers that I think are consistent with what kids need now, that are actually different markers, then they can actually do a lot of help in helping launch their children during this emerging adulthood period. It's a period of transition. It's another period of parenting.
Another period of parenting, kind of a new one. I can, again, think of 20-somethings not so many decades ago where their parents were the last thing they really wanted to interact with often.
That's right.
Jeffrey Arnett, do you see it, a new stage in parenting, and do you think that's also, does that fit into your positive picture of this?
Yes, it does. That's one of the things that struck me in interviewing emerging adults is how well they tend to get along with their parents and how much better they get along with them and like them than they did when they were adolescents. And it's very gratifying to the parents, as I think Linda would agree,
mm-hmm.
because often adolescence is a high conflict period with parents. And they get to emerging adulthood, and often it changes and becomes much more positive. And they treat each other much more as equals, or at least near equals.
But can all parents afford this?
They like to hang around and do things socially. It's a surprise to both of them.
Can parents afford to keep putting out the room and board and maybe the pocket money or more as well? Is there a cash drain on people maybe planning retirement or trying to?
Well, most middle-class parents can. Again, American society is a lot more affluent than it was 40, 50 years ago for the middle class. And the parents have fewer children than their own parents did. And so, yeah, often they do have the money. And they're usually quite willing to help their emerging adults financially as long as the emerging adults have some plan. Both Linda and that earlier caller, Joe,
yes. mm-hmm.
Reflected that. He has a plan. He's in school.
Yep.
He's going to work on a degree. So it's fine with his parents if he stays home during that period.
He's
and Linda mentioned her own daughter who had moved home, I think, for an internship or before grad school.
Right.
As long as there's a plan, the parents are happy to have him around for a while. Neither the parents or the emerging adults want it to last forever.
Jeffrey Arnett, Linda Perlman-Gordon, we've got to take a short break here. We're talking about today's 20-somethings and emerging adulthood, slowly emerging adulthood. Is there a problem with putting off the ways of full adulthood? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about today's 20-somethings back home in the basement or out in the world, but putting off full adulthood, and you can see it in all kinds of ways. Parents with stories of the kids coming back home after college. I'm just looking here at a chart that shows the median age of marriage in the United States from 1950 to 2000. By the year 2000, for women, median marriage age looks to me, looking at this chart, like it's just north of 24 years old. For men, median age of marriage, 27. Both of those a good 4 or 5 years older than they were in 1950. Things are changing here, changing at home, changing in the way people move into what Jeffrey Arnett calls emerging adulthood in his new book. We're also joined tonight by Linda Perlman-Gordon. She's co-author of Mom, Can I Move Back In With You? A survival guide for parents of 20-somethings. And right now from Washington, Kathy Stocker, co-author of the forthcoming book, The Quarter-Lifer's Companion. She's the 34-year-old director of business development for the website quarterlifecrisis.org. Kathy Stocker, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So, Quarter Life Crisis, a book came out on that not so very long ago, and I guess that's exactly what we're in the middle of here, quarterlifecrisis.org, and I just rifled through it quickly today, and I see here conversation threads. Here's from someone saying that the headline is, Confused, Bored, Restless. I'm a 25-year-old working on my second bachelor's degree. I'm totally confused, bored, and restless with almost every aspect of my life. I'm the queen of pity parties. Here's another one saying, somebody saying, I'm in such a cozy and comfortable position. I'll look back in 10, 15, 20 years from now and regret that I'm not doing it. I'm not sure what that is. I'm such a sissy. Is this a self-pitying tone, the tone of 20-somethings in the quarter-life crisis?
Well, I think that there, you know, we hear a lot of different voices on the message boards. It's quarterlifecrisis.com,
so your
viewers can go to the right site. And I do think that there is an element, you know, that feels sorry for itself. But there's also an element that makes fun of the fact that they feel sorry for themselves.
Yes.
But I think that we hear a lot of the same themes that we've talked about so far.
But you call it crisis, and our other guests have not. Why do you call it crisis?
Well, when my co-author on the upcoming book, Abby Wilner, who coined the phrase in her first book, Quarter Life Crisis, The Unique Challenges of Life in Your 20s, you know, she was trying to make a comparison with the midlife crisis, that there had been a lot of national conversation about the midlife crisis, and what she felt was minimal conversation about the transition that 20-somethings go through once they graduate from school and try to move on in their professional lives.
And what's the crisis aspect of that? We understand what the midlife crisis is supposed to be about, but what about this one in the 20s? It seems young for a crisis.
I think that the prevailing aspect of the quarter-life crisis is coming out of school and feeling an overwhelming sense of options and the pressure to make the right choice. When Linda was talking about the expectations that our parents place on us and our own expectations for ourselves, there's a fear of being, quote-unquote, just normal.
As opposed to exceptional.
Our parents have built us up exactly to believe that we are capable of exceptional things.
Where every child is above average.
Exactly. And so when we graduate, we feel this pressure to find the perfect job and the great job and the job that our parents can brag about and the jobs, frankly, that we can brag about at our first high school reunion. And it can be extremely deflating to graduate and realize that you may not even be able to find a job, let alone a job that's going to sound, you know, romantic and
or impressive
successful.
To yourself or your friends or your parents. It can be intimidating.
Right.
I also see on the message board here somebody, Paige, she's posted a quote from Mark Twain. Mark Twain saying, courage is resistance to fear, mastery of fear, not absence of fear. So don't be ashamed to be afraid in that 20-something transition. Tiffany's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Tiffany. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks.
I'm very interested in this conversation because I'm nearing 30.
Okay.
And when I graduated from college, I had no idea what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I graduated with psychology as my bachelor's, and I started going to graduate school and everything. I was one of the people that made the average age for marrying 24.
Okay, right.
So
you did it.
25.
Almost 25 now for women, but yeah, you're right in there.
You know, but you're
29 now. Are you? So I take it you're not living at home.
No, not living at home now. But when I first graduated, I never moved back home.
Mm-hmm.
But it was understood that I could call back and, you know, ask for help. But there was some kind of I don't know if there was like an era of, okay, well, you graduate, you're on your own, you know, but you could call back for help. Don't move back home unless there's an emergency or something.
So to paint it very straight, in other words, you could ask for cash but not move in? Is that it?
It was never said don't move back in,
mm-hmm.
but it was just the sense of, okay, you're grown.
And what about it? Are you glad that you faced that kind of unspoken resistance to moving back home, or do you wish you could have? Would it have been helpful?
No, I'm glad, actually, because my husband's brother graduated from the same college, and
mm-hmm.
He's 25, I think. He's gone back home. And I just noticed the difference in my husband. He's military, and I just noticed the difference that I don't think he could have really gone back home. It's the idea of you being grown. But his brother moved back home. There's no problem at all.
And was it good for his brother? Did it work out all right? Did he go on?
It's still working out. I mean,
okay.
I don't think he ever plans on moving. I mean, he pretty much told his parents, pick out a rocking chair on the old folks' home.
Oh, boy. They're going to be the ones moving. We've got it. Tiffany, thanks so much for your call. Linda Perlman-Gordon, What about it? You've described the upside of sharing some more time together in the family home. Mm-hmm. Can there be a downside there? Can it insulate young Americans from kind of coming to grips with the world?
Probably the truth to everything. You need a certain balance, and so you literally have to have a dance that's done between parents and child. And that means that you've got to set down certain boundaries and speak about them beforehand.
Such as?
Such as if you have a job and you wake up and got to get up at 7 in the morning, and you have a kid who just graduated from college and is out with his friends and comes in, doesn't have his key, rings the doorbell at 3 a.m., wakes you up, or is loud with friends, that's not okay. But it's also the same kind of courtesy and empathy that you want your child to have if they had roommates.
But what about if that child who's come back home and is out partying until 3 a.m. Yeah. and not working when you're heading off to work, in your book, is it all right to be giving them the eyeball and saying...
Absolutely. You have to.
Why aren't you working, though? Not just don't ring the doorbell, but why don't you have a job, or is that old-fashioned?
But we don't know. Of course you need to sit down and see that. And again, I'm gonna mention what we call these markers of adulthood, because these markers are what make these questions that you're asking. What happens is parents are able to answer them for themselves. So, for instance, is your child becoming financially independent? If your son or daughter is not looking for a job or not doing something to help support her or himself, then that's not okay. Your child is not moving towards adulthood.
So at least be on the path. Let's get another call.
Absolutely.
Adam is calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
We're great, thanks.
Good. I've got a question, and it has to do with how this issue involves class.
Yes.
I'm a second-generation American. When my grandparents came here, they had basically nothing. They worked very hard.
Yep.
And they ended up owning a building in Queens.
Mm-hmm.
And when my mom got married, they couldn't understand why they didn't want to move in with them.
Mm-hmm.
Because the whole family lived in the building.
Right. That was the whole assumption then.
So I'm wondering if I'm just kind of curious on how this all goes together with the class of people. I mean, is this just an upper middle class suburban phenomenon? Is this happening also with young adults in inner cities and urban areas?
Let us pick it straight up. Kathy Stucker, what can you tell us about that? Is the quarter life crisis equally available no matter where you are in the sort of socioeconomic range, or is this an upper middle class precious phenomenon?
We tend to see this issue more among college graduates, and I think partly because they feel that a lot has been invested in them. They feel that they've invested a lot in their education. They're probably in debt when they graduate, and so there's a tremendous amount of pressure to find a great job, start paying off student loans, somehow find a way to put a down payment on a condo. But we definitely hear from people across classes, across economic backgrounds, on our message boards and in our work with 20-somethings across the country.
But it feels tilted toward the upper classes. Jeffrey Arnett, what about it? Is there a version of this at lower income levels, at working class income levels, to use a phrase that itself sounds old-fashioned, but it's not. There is that class.
No, I think it does go across classes, emerging adult as I've described it. I think the marriage age is late and age of parenthood is late across classes, although there's some variation. But I think the real difference in terms of class is that the people who are working class struggle a lot more than the college graduates that Kathy's talking about.
Struggle
they have
to do
a lot
what
fewer
exactly?
Options. Mm-hmm. The crisis that she's talking about is really a product of a multiplicity of options. So many options, you don't know where to begin.
And big expectations.
Whereas for people who are working class, because they don't have as much education, they don't have nearly as many options for the kind of job they would like to get.
So do they become adults at the traditional age, or are they also delaying that kind of maturation into full adulthood or not?
They're also delaying it, but they have different prospects. What's happened in the last 50 years economically, and the caller before alluded to it, is that the manufacturing jobs have really disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And so the average wage for people who have a high school education or less has gone down. in the last 40 years, adjusted for inflation, whereas for college graduates, it's continued to go up. And so there's more and more of a split in terms of the economic prospects for college graduates versus those who have only graduated from high school.
It must be harder to be bouncing around with those lower prospects. Emily's calling from Boston. Hi, Emily. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
We're great. Thanks, Emily.
Really kind of all I just wanted to say is that, you know, I'm 22. I just moved to Boston.
Yeah.
I just graduated in May.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, it's kind of shocked me how just a college degree really isn't worth what it was 20 years ago. And so we can't get these great jobs when we first graduate. I mean, I was really, really lucky and had a job when I graduated, but I had to move home for 2 months. And it was, my parents were really great about it. I mean, they knew that I was going somewhere. They knew that I had some direction. But I have plenty of friends who, you know, they moved home and they didn't do anything. And their parents finally said, you know what, you're not doing anything, so you got to leave.
And what do you see, what do you feel among those friends, even with yourself now, Emily? Do you feel, wow, this is great, I've got years, I don't have to have kids or get married right away, I can kind of work the whole waterfront here and look for the perfect career, the perfect love, or do you see, I don't know, anxiety about it?
Well, a little bit of both. I mean, I think people are making some excellent points, and it's really important to discuss this because this is a real phenomenon of our generation. And it really seems like, you know, and it's true. I mean, we're talking about how the factory jobs are all gone, but, I mean, even if they were here, would we really take them? I mean, we've kind of grown up, our parents have put these expectations, these great expectations that, you know, don't settle, take what you can get, take the best that you can get. And so my friends who, you know, are working, you know, some job that they're really, they're not proud of it. They want something better. We are, you know, this generation of romantics. You want only the best, and when we can't get that, we're very disappointed.
Don't settle. Go for the best. We hear it, Emily. And yet life isn't always just perfect. Linda Perlman-Gordon, where do you see this all going? And try to look at it broadly, not just upper-middle-class youths who may be supported for a long time and may, in fact, be the ones who stay in the house when their parents, you know, go down to the Boca Raton house. How's this going to work out for people?
Well, I think I'm trying to be really simple. It's such a big, big, big issue. I really think what we need to do is we need to look at our parenting. I agree again with Jeffrey that this is the way the world is now. It's not broken. It's just the way it is.
It's just different.
But within that, parents have to learn how to stop fixing things for their kids. They have to be less hyper-involved. I know that there are colleges now that when they give their tours in the summer and the freshmen are coming, they have to put the parents somewhere because the parents were interrupting the kids' experiences.
You mean the parents were asking all the questions
absolutely.
On the tour instead of the kids?
Oh, absolutely. Boy. And it's just the way things are now. So what's going to happen, and that's why you're hearing all of this new kind of coddling stuff, it's not necessarily all about 20-somethings. I think you're going to hear about it even about the younger kids moving up. It's something that we have to look at in our parenting, and part of it is because we're having the kids later now. And when you've done a lot of your partying in your 20s and you have a baby at 30, you start to treat it differently than you would if you were, you know, younger and you were dying for some free time.
Well, give them wings, but also look at a changed society and maybe just a changed relationship between generations. We are out of time. Linda Perlman-Gordon, author of Mom, Can I Move Back In With You? Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Jeffrey Arnett, author of Emerging Adulthood. Wonderful to have you from the University of Maryland. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Kathy Stocker, co-author of the forthcoming The Quarter Lifer's Companion. Thanks a lot for joining us, Kathy.
Thank you. Good evening.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.